Great, thanks. Okay, thanks for your patience with that. Meeting is called to order. Done a roll call, and since then, Ms. Powell has, we have all five members here today. So, wanted to recognize any newly licensed chiropractors in the state. You're required to attend one of these meetings, or here in person or virtually. I appreciate that, and I think the meeting, be notified when you're done. Moving on to tab 1. This is a matter of Dr. Jed Castro. Number 7545. How about a motion? Okay, Dr. Zastro, are you present? Find out to Dr. Zastro twice. If you are present, virtually, you need to unmute yourself and say hello. Okay. Representative?
Yes, Board Chair, Board Members, Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan representing the state today.
Okay, and then Dr. Jed Zastro, are you representative or present? An allegation submitted was filed by the state and a copy mailed to the respondent at his or her last known argument.
No, but the state will present its motion to deem right now. So this matter came before, thank you, board members, this matter came before the board March,
I apologize,
the complaint came in on March 25th, 2021, involving allegations that the respondent was engaged in the use of drugs and alcohol, did not maintain patient records, and was a danger to health, safety, and welfare. Based on that, the board opened an investigation. During the investigation, the board determined that the respondent had tested positive for methamphetamines on an unrelated matter on July 9, 2022. During a review of this matter at the board's August 30, 2022 meeting, the respondent admitted to accidentally using methamphetamine and also failed to comply with the subpoena that was sent on August 8. Based on those allegations, the board offered an interim consent agreement not to practice during the course of the investigation, as well as a drug test and substance abuse evaluation. That was not complied with in 30 days. November 30th, 2022, the board moved this matter to a formal hearing. The respondent was issued this by, I believe it was, process server on December 1st, 2022. At the last known residence where the respondent had indicated on his application that he lived, the respondent's mother answered the door, confirmed that he did live there, but would not accept the service. The service was left at the door, and the regular mail did not come back as undeliverable. So based on this information, state believes that the respondent was properly served and has failed to comply with the requirements to respond. Respectfully request that the allegations stated in the complaint be deemed admitted and the board proceed with imposing disciplinary action against the respondent in lieu of proceeding to a formal hearing. Thank you.
Establish that the respondent is not here, so there's no motion granting.
Chairman, I move to grant the state's motion to deem allegations admitted.
Second the motion.
Aye. Dr. Wayne Bennett.
Aye.
Dr. Stephen Knopf.
Aye.
Ms. Mitchell Turbinson.
Aye.
Ms. Angela Powell.
Aye.
Dr. Richard Farina?
Aye. And then to adding some facts.
Chairman, I move that we adopt the factual allegations in the complaint and notice hearing as findings of facts and the alleged violations in the complaint and notice of hearing as conclusions of law.
Second. Aye.
Aye.
And then kind of go through.
The state really doesn't have an argument, but the individual has failed to respond, and the allegations are pretty egregious, and the fact that the respondent was using methamphetamines was confirmed by the respondent. So I would just take that into consideration with deciding what that discipline would be.
I make a motion, Mr. Chairman, a procedural question. In the event that the board were to, board's recommendation was revocation of license, would that require that we move forward to a formal hearing, or are we able to do that now, or what are our options relative to that? I move that we, for immediate revocation of this question.
I second the motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for further discussion, I know one of the issues in this matter was he seemed to have no regard, whether licensed or otherwise, to continue seeing patients. So my question is there a process of where we have to refer this matter to the general to ensure that he's not practicing potentially without a license if the right.
It's the state's understanding that he did not renew his license this year, so he does not have a license currently.
Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Wayne Bennett?
Aye.
Dr. Stephen Cannell?
Aye.
Mr. Mitchell Torpenson?
Aye.
Ms. Angela Powell?
Aye.
Dr. Richard Carino?
Aye. Have it.
Thank you, Morgan.
Chairman, I see tab number two as being Haggard being number tab number three. Are we moving to that?
We updated. I apologize. We did update the agenda maybe since you downloaded your material, and we removed the original tab number two, and so Dr. Haggard is downtown number two.
I
apologize for that. Mr. Chair, our chair, before you, you have the agreement that was proposed at the last board meeting between the board and Dr. Haggard regarding his case. There were no changes to what you ordered, so this is just for you to confirm that that's what we provided to you and that you're comfortable with this agreement. If you have any changes or additions, you can still add those at this time, and we'll take that back too.
Members, we are looking at a consent agreement.
And board members, just for the record, I did include pretty much all the facts in there, and they did not ask for any revisions. So that is all the facts.
There being no apparent discussion, Mr. Chairman, I move that the board approve the consent agreement as proposed.
Okay. Hey, welcome. Unmute yourself in a bit. Introduce yourself to the record, please.
Good morning. Mandy Harvest of Wicker Smith, appearing with and on behalf of my client, Dr. Harvey Abrams.
Hi, it's Dr. Harvey Abrams.
Hi, welcome.
The allegations are misleading advertising, danger to the health, safety, and welfare, breach of doctor-patient confidentiality, and a secret means of treatment.
Dr. Reno, members of the board. Dr. Abrams obviously acknowledged the inappropriate behavior here with respect to the supplements. It was obviously very poor judgment on his part, which he regrets very much. When the board ordered him to take and pass all sections of the EBAS, he did so without being ordered by the board. He also took some continuing education courses. Since that time, we have spoken with Mr. Dominic about the possibility of entering into a consent agreement. We are just, we've just been going back and forth with some of the terms. We believe that all of the terms are within reason. We are just going back and forth with respect to the amount of continuing education and the amount of the civil penalty. And then we were also discussing about supplements and specifically what the restrictions would be in that regard. So we anticipate entering into a consent agreement if the board would entertain such an agreement. But that's essentially where we are. But Dr. Abrams wanted to come before the board. Since last time we were, it was virtual appearance, he did want to appear before you and answer any other questions that the board members may have about the situation. But we do anticipate having a consent agreement for you for approval at the next meeting.
So board members, we've got cases we're dealing with up three. You may recall that he was here for another matter. We're not having issues. Do you have any questions, Mr. Dr. Abrams, and Members, any questions?
I have a question with regard to, by way of a preface, I want to commend you, Dr. Abrams, for being proactive about stepping up on this issue and helping this process move forward. I've looked at the consent agreement, and I'm inclined to agree with it, but there is one point of clarity I think we need, and that is part of the consent agreement was can I clarify that under the proposed probationary consent agreement item 4, it's a $2,000 penalty, $500 for each violation. So we have we did identify 4 violations.
That's what's in the investigative fact.
I have no further questions or comments. I think we can just move forward.
I've got a follow-up. You said that there is a number of CEs already taken. What was the amount and what were the courses, if you don't mind?
I don't know that I have the specific titles of the courses, but we did submit those to the board. He took some continuing education at my recommendation. He took actually ethics and social safety and healthcare, ethics and the importance of integrity. He also did some self-study, being the power of ethics, how to make good choices, and has identified some other courses. So he has already taken some ethics courses. I believe those were both 2-hour courses that he actually took, one through life chiropractic. So he's already completed 4 hours of ethics voluntarily, specifically related to the situation.
And those
that's correct. And just for clarification's sake, one of the again, one of the proposed potential revisions that we had discussed with respect to the consent agreement was perhaps changing the penalty to $250 per violation, making the total civil penalty $1,000, and then providing respect to item 6, giving him a certain amount of time to otherwise get rid of the remaining inventory with respect to supplements, and whether or not that would preclude everyone in his office, because he also has an independent contractor that works there, from being in charge of those supplements. Something that we're going to seek clarification from, with the remaining terms, other than a potential modification of the amount of hours that are required for continuing ed in light of what he's already taken, would be acceptable and accepted by Dr. Abrams if offered.
Mr. Chair, rest of the board members, but what's proposed in front of us, I do think we take into consideration the number of hours already taken, being proactive in this matter. And I do think item number 6, the restriction of selling supplements off the shelf. Areas where you have contractors in there, they're independent, and they're wanting to sell these items. So my thought is we strike 6.
And if I may, in that regard, Dr. Knopf, obviously, by the time a matter gets to the board for consideration, the anonymous complaint originated in September of 2021. He acknowledged the issue since that time. Supplements other than Black Oxygen, which was discontinued for obvious reasons, have been sold and provided to customers and patients without issue. So we believe that that issue is taken care of, and it would obviously provide access to the folks that have been using those supplements, it would prevent them from having to go elsewhere. So appropriate, obviously, to for him to or someone else at the office to do that and have the board have to.
Still a lot of different items and supplements. I think monitoring it in general would be for us and for on our. I don't know that there's no way to do that.
I appreciate the conundrum. I also appreciate that the issue that brought us to this point is a behavior that this particular clause or section number 6 is one that specifically addresses that behavior. So I'm reluctant to favor taking it out. However, I do believe that, and I also believe that, well, and I know from personal experience as a practitioner that online supplement, providing supplements on an online availability to patients is a very expedient way of delivering supplements. I don't view it as a deterrent in terms of safety to the public or access to the public. And I believe that perhaps just, but I'm sensitive to the fact that there may be other people in the environment that would wish to sell directly. I would suggest that we, instead of saying at his practice location, just say to his patients. And that way it would not restrict sales, on-site sales from other providers. But I would be reluctant to eliminate those completely.
I just have a question. So are all the vitamins and supplements removed from the shelf now?
I'm sorry.
Are they gone?
Supplements? No, the supplements. The supplements that were
mislabeled.
Labeled have been.
Everything's been taken off.
Absolutely.
And the relabels.
Yes.
So now you just have current supplements on the shelf, and that's what we're deciding whether or not these are labeled.
Yes.
For a third party.
Sell them from a live. Off-the-shelf basis online.
I tend to think you've learned in favor of saying you shouldn't be able to sell them. There's other kinds of supplements you can sell patients. They're online for patients to order directly. I suppose that should be considered.
Okay, and I am sympathetic to your statement. However, I'm looking back at David's performance history before this board, and he has multiple reappearances. I appreciate what he's done so far, but I think we need to have power to enforce more accountability.
Okay, go.
Sure. I move that the board authorize staff and attorney to negotiate a consent agreement that complies with the recommendations from staff but reflects a reduction in hours for ethics and risk management of 4 hours, changes item 6 language to read to his patients, replacing at his patient at his practice location.
Okay.
I do not.
If not, sign me.
Third.
You are. Call me all day.
This is the Managed Harvest meeting?
Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Mandy Carvis of Wicker Smith, appearing with and on behalf of Dr. Lajeunesse, who's also present.
Yes. Dr. Lajeunesse.
The investigative facts are improper billing as it relates to fee splitting and making false statements.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, as the board is aware, this is a self-report on behalf of Dr. Lajeunesse. She also appeared and spoke before this board with respect to the complaint against Dr. Mike Papamathiakis last month, so the board is very aware of the situation. It's always a challenging thing for a practitioner to do, to come to their licensing board and basically tell on themselves and say, I realize that I've done something inappropriate, and rather than just hiding her head in the sand and hoping that nobody would find out about it, she did the right thing. She stepped up. She informed the board about what she learned, that despite the fact that it was presented to her that this was appropriate and that there were lots of chiropractors and lots of offices that were doing this, when she sought her own legal counsel regarding a potential revision of the contract, she learned that it was, in fact, not appropriate, and it was essentially the literal definition of fee splitting. As she explained to this board when she appeared before, it has cost her a great deal in terms of her business, her personal situation. She's still dealing with a lot of fallout from that, including ongoing civil litigation against her intimidatory tactics, things of that nature. She's cooperated with the board. She participated in an investigative interview, provided them with information, has been forthcoming regarding the situation. She's happy to answer any questions that the board members may have. She is willing to work with board staff to enter into some sort of consent agreement so that the board knows that going forward, that her practice will not have these types of issues. There will be some challenges in that regard because obviously the concern is with respect to fees and billing and fee splitting. That really won't be happening. But how much oversight into her billing and record keeping going forward is truly the question. One other remaining issue that is somewhat tied to this that would be helpful for Dr. Danielle to have some clarity on is there are a number of patients who were provided treatment by her at Garden Lakes Chiropractic under this practice model that she did not know was inappropriate at the time. Those fees have since potentially been collected by Dr. Mike in Collision Chiropractic. Dr. Danielle has not received any payment from any of those. That's been obviously a huge financial strain to her. But given everything, she hasn't wanted to pursue that and have the board deem that is essentially her taking fruit from a poisonous tree when she's already self-reported. If you have other questions for her, she's happy to address them, but I think the board has handle on the situation and how we got here. And again, we would ask that the board consider the fact that she stepped up and she did the right thing, and she informed you once she realized that the situation was not appropriate. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I appreciate you. So we've heard a lot of the testimony through, but I feel like we kind of need to go through it and get it on the record. I'm going to say something to be obvious, and you can help me. As you participated in a splitting agreement with Collision Chiropractors, 926, give you the actual fee schedule and prices that you were to charge the patient. And the deal basically was that they were going to coordinate any referrals that needed to happen once the patient for an MRI or for an orthopedic consult would use their forms on their head to ask patient to make esophagus. Chiropractors, they would then say that, okay, this patient needs an MRI for order, and then they would send it to anybody that they were working with, the team, to go ahead and get that. In return, then you were taking 50% of whatever they collected. We had a $5,000 bill, and they collected $2,500 of that, then you would get half of $2,500, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so you were using their letterhead as your practice address for patients. And so you had a different fee schedule then for your regular patients?
No.
Like how did you manage? They gave you the fee schedule for Collision Chiropractors. Had your own patients from, right? So how did you handle that part of it?
I had to adopt their fee schedule. I had to make that my fee schedule. I could only have one fee schedule.
For the
patients? All patients.
Sent to you.
All patients. It became my fee schedule. And that became a problem as he kept upping his fee schedule.
Okay, so if you had a patient that came to you unrelated to Collision Chiropractor and they were a self-pay patient, you would charge them
a time of service discount based on that fee schedule.
Okay. All right, thank you. So when I read through the contract, I saw that there was on a consent retreat form on page 33 of our materials, 15, that the patient was consenting Mecca and Hispana with Dr. Papamazic's leading case there. Can you tell me why that was important and why that was important? Did that have to do with patient coming in?
How
would they
have to consent to that? And that was, I'm sorry, Dr. Moreno, that was on the consent
retreat. This is in one of our exhibits. We have all of the forms that the patient have to sign on a new intake consent retreat form. And print on that, it said, I didn't understand why that was there.
Is that the paperwork utilized for Collision of notes? Okay, so we at Garden Lake Chiropractic, when we would see a patient for Collision, we did not use that paperwork. However, it was given to us, but we actually used different paperwork.
Okay.
So I didn't quite read through all of that. We didn't use it.
Okay. I have a lot of other questions, and I'm sure my board members do as well, so I'm going to let them go ahead and have some questions. Let's start with Ms. Paul.
I just have one quick question. Did you ever speak to the attorney who drafted the contract? No, I did not. Were you told it was drafted by an attorney? Yes, I was. Did you don't know who it was?
No.
Did you think to take it at that time to an attorney for review?
No, I did not.
Did you feel like it was an attorney who drafted the contract? I mean, would it be safe to say you relied on that?
I was. I did ask. I was told by Dr. Mike that his attorney did draft up the paperwork. Everything was on the up and up. Everything was legal. And honestly, I did not have any reason to doubt it at that time because I was under the impression. I knew of other that specific business model being utilized by several people in the state of Arizona for over 15 plus years, as long as I've been licensed for 21 years.
Right.
It really wasn't didn't come to mind.
All right. Thank you.
When did you become involved with Collision?
It was in September 2017.
How did you hear about involved with the program? Did he approach you, or did you hear about it?
I heard about it. I heard about it. I knew that Dr. Mike had worked for Dr. Hardy. They were in a legal battle. Dr. Mike went off on his own. Basically was looking for practices to refer patients to. It was just presented to me that, hey, you know, Dr. Mike's looking for a location. It was very nonchalant. It was, again, just common. I didn't question it. I was familiar with that business model, again.
How many other doctors or clinics do you think are partnered with them? Do you have any idea?
At this time, I'm not sure, but at one time, 40.
And at what point did you start to question the contract and
It was roughly 2021 when Dr. Mike and his brother George decided to open up or start doing the same thing with the naturopathic clinics with the three named Med Royal, and they started referring every patient was being sent to Med Royal. And that's when my associate doctor at the time was who was seeing all the Collision chiropractic patients was coming to me and expressing concern that the patients were not getting the appropriate treatment that she was filling out on the Collision Chiro form. They were basically just being sent to Med Royal. And it was happening too often. And then that's when I started questioning. It was basically when I was starting to see the patients being treated. It wasn't just chiropractic. It was now being involved with medical. So, yeah, at that time.
When did the diet set cut with Dr. Mike in chiropractic? When have you stopped accepting?
It was, I'm drawing a blank here. I'm sorry, I shouldn't move it.
She made the self-report July of 2022.
It's April 27th. April 27th is when I terminated the contract.
You started to have some deaths 2021 and started to build.
Well, I took certain steps to correct the system, make people aware I did it anonymously, of course, and I also had other issues, internal issues, business issues with having a business partner that had 50% decision-making, which we were in disagreement. I wanted to stop then. She did not. So everything was done anonymously to try to pose correct, make everybody just do the right thing, and where everybody could just stop. And that backfired because nothing was done. Everything just kept going, and my business partner just said, you know, see, nothing's wrong. Dr. Mike was right. The contract's legal. The attorneys wrote it up. Court's not taking action. The doctors are not getting off. Nothing's happening. So it's, you know, I didn't want to become a target. Obviously, I have become a target, as everybody knows. But at the time when it just came to the point where I finally just terminated the contract, regardless of the consequences of having to deal with my business partner, is who now suing me for unilaterally terminating a contract without her approval.
Questions I have for now, thank you.
Okay. And so for the record, was your partner Dr. Denise Young?
She was my associate doctor.
So who was your business partner?
In LaFrance. She's 50% owner of Garnwood Chiropractic. As she labeled herself managing member of Garnwood Chiropractic.
Okay, so is she still a 50% owner?
Currently, we're in all that. So. Yes, right now.
Clarification on that.
Yes, Dr. Legend, it's Wayne Bennett. I too was curious about the use of the reference to Clinical Medica Hispana. And just to clarify, that consent agreement was not the form that you used in your clinic?
No, it was a form that Kim LaFrance acquired from Dr. Mike at the beginning, the very beginning when we started taking patients, but we never used his forms. I believe that he was using.
Okay, so to your knowledge, that language you reference to that clinic and to any lease of space does not appear in the consent agreement that was used for patients in your practice. Is that correct?
Correct.
and who is DT Medical?
DT Medical is a medical, it's Dr. Tran. He's a medical provider that sees personal injury. He does personal injury med evals and treatment.
Like pain management or pain surgery?
Just general, I believe he does like issues or oral medication. He will manage the medical part of a patient. Of a personal injury patient. So if they need referrals, he'll handle referrals. If they need imaging, he's a medical physician.
So more of a case management role? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
He's a medical provider, an MD. But yeah.
I understand the credential. My question is, what is his role? I heard you say something about oral pain management medication, and I heard you sound like you were saying more about making decisions about referrals and those kinds of things, which would be more management.
Trying to
clarify his role.
Right, he doesn't get involved. And he's completely separate. He's a completely separate. He's a physician that I would utilize for, I would refer for medical, like if the patient, let's say they went to the ER and they come to me and they don't have a primary care physician, but yet they've been issued muscle relaxers, pain medication. That's out of my scope, so I would refer to Dr. Tran to handle that post-ER follow-up. Like, that's as much as I know about Dr. Tran.
That sounds a lot like a pain management doctor to me. Is that?
Well, primary care, mostly not. To me, I'm sorry, pain management I view more as the epidurals or more advanced procedures. Dr. Tran does, at the most, I believe, trigger point injections.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And so is there any relationship between DC Medical, to your knowledge, any relationship between DC Medical and Collision Chiropractic? Okay. And the relationship that you have with them is on a separate entity referral basis, and those referrals are made by you to that provider?
Correct.
And so there are no cases where Collision Chiropractic patients would be referred to DC Medical?
Not unless Dr. Mike referred them.
Okay, and did I just hear you a little while ago say you have no knowledge of that ever having occurred?
There may be one or two cases, I can't name which ones, that I initially, maybe at the beginning, Dr. Mike may have used DC Medical. But I am not 100% sure.
Yeah, I'm just trying to clarify some things here. And in reading the transcripts of the of your interview with Dominic, some questions there. You say that at some point, at some intervals in time, you were receiving in the neighborhood of 60 referrals per month from Collision Chiropractic. Is that correct?
That was at the most, and it was possibly 1 month, the entire contract, yes.
And then you said more likely between 30 and 50. So, but the bottom end range would be like 30 referrals per month.
Yes.
So you, in your conversation with Mr. Dominic, you talked about patients would come in and advise you that they had been referred to someone without your knowledge. I'm reading here, I didn't understand why the patient would just come in and say, oh, hey, you know, I got referred to a neuro, blah, 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 blah. And then it goes on. You did say that, correct?
Yes, I did.
And so you will testify today that was the case, that referrals were made on patients under your care without your knowledge?
There were on occasion when my associate doctor would tell me that that she had not referred the patient to a certain specialist and the patient ended up.
That's not the nature of my question. My question is, where's there ever a situation where you, in that scenario you just described, the decision had been made on your part or your provider's part that a referral was appropriate? And what I'm asking you is, were there instances where you were surprised to learn that a referral was made without your knowledge or recommendation?
Yes.
Can you describe a scenario like that?
One scenario, okay, so patient is doing well, patient is feeling better, patient is maybe 2-3 visits from being discharged by my associate doctor, and then Dr. Young is asked to refer the patient for an MRI. Dr. Young disagrees with the referral. She doesn't follow through with it, and the patient gets sent for an MRI regardless.
Okay, and thank you. And in those scenarios, what clinical information what clinical information would be available to Collision Chiropractic, whoever made the referral from Collision Chiropractic, Dr. Papamathiakis or his designee? What information did they have to make that clinical decision-making?
Nothing, because the notes were never requested. Was not contacted.
Okay. So just to clarify, is your belief, based on the evidence that you have, that referrals were made for services that you did not consider to be medically necessary and those decisions were made, could not have been made based upon any clinical records or consultation with the user provider. Okay. And can you give me, would this happen one time? Do you think this happened numerous times? What is your suspicion with regard to that?
Hard for me to answer. The other reason why it would be hard for me to answer is because I was partially removed from Collision Chiropractors, being at the time Dr. Denise Young or the associate doctor treats patients. And him and I not agreeing with continuing business with Collision, Kim LaFrance took charge of Collision Chiropractors. So a lot of what I submitted or presented were documents or different things that were recovered just recently or after the fact. I wasn't involved in the day-to-day as much as Kim LaFrance was in the associate doctor.
I understand. Thank you. Did you personally treat any Collision Chiropractic patients?
I did.
Okay. And, thank you. The referrals that were made by Collision Chiropractic for patients in your clinic, both those which you and your associates believe to be medically necessary and those that you did not, for those referrals, you mentioned earlier, you brought up the name Med Royal earlier, and I thought I heard you say that the majority of the referrals went to that, to Med Royal. Is that correct?
Yes.
Could you provide an estimate, ballpark, that we won't hold you to? But just to get an idea, was it a small number? Was it a majority? Was it a vast majority? What would you say?
Vast majority, like 99%.
Okay. And at any time, are you aware that you or one of your providers felt as though the care was not medically necessary at the time?
For the Med Royal?
Bad question. The referrals that we're now talking about, in the event that, were there instances where you felt that they were not medically necessary, the referrals were made without medical necessity? That's the first part of the question. Okay. And in the event of those occurrences, what, if any, dialogue from you or your providers occurred with regard to protecting the patient about those issues?
Other than my associate doctor just discussing it with me, and again, it was mostly the associate doctor discussing it with Kim, because Kim had most of the correspondence back and forth with Dr. Mike. So... I'm not explaining it well. Well, everybody did go to Med Royal. There wasn't much that we could do, to be honest with you. First of all, the patient would still be, or often, sent to Med Royal before they even came to our clinic.
Okay.
Or the referral.
All right. So the nature, and I appreciate your situation. My question here is, our role as a board is primarily public safety. You, as the owner, responsible party for Garden Lake Chiropractic, are accountable for whatever goes on in your clinic. So the question is, if you became aware of referrals that were made or services that were not medically necessary for the patient, do you feel as though you would have an obligation to the patient to intervene and do something about that?
I did. I just didn't do it coming forward my name.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say, excuse me for interrupting, what I'm hearing you saying is ultimately accumulated enough, then you finally step forward because of that. So that was part of your motivation relative to stepping forward. Is that correct? Okay, thank you. In your interview, your dialogue transcript, you described a advanced pain management. You described patients who needed referral and they were sent, and I'm just verifying this as an example. These patients were sent for things like massage and cupping, and that was done at Med Royal, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you described in one case a patient who had concussive symptoms, they were vomiting, she had dizziness, sleep disturbances, headaches, neck pain, the whole thing, you or your provider, Dr. Young, sent out for an MRI and a brain and cervical spine, which sounds like it would be an appropriate intervention. And the MRI referral was canceled, and that the patient was sent for some other type of care instead of the MRI. So in this case, a specific recommendation that was salient to the patient's safety and health was countervened by closing chiropractic. Is that correct? Okay. And would you be able to provide the patient records if that requested by the board for that specific case?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. And okay. And for the record, are you aware that anyone from Collision Chiropractic either reviewed the records or interviewed that patient to make that decision?
As my knowledge, no, the records were not requested and the patient was
dead. Okay, so if that decision was made and it does not appear in your medical record, and if it did not appear in any other medical record, then that would demonstrate that decisions are being made about these patients that are outside of accepted practices. Okay. So, Dr. Young was the primary provider for CC patients, for collision chiropractic patients?
Yes.
And would you, again, not holding you to a number, but most of, vast majority, handful?
The chiro patients?
Yes, ma'am.
All.
Okay. And for the record, we have been privy to some of the medical records from Collision Chiropractic that were authored by Dr. Young, and it would be my medical recommendation that we investigate them, because the records that I had the opportunity to review were far below standard accepted recommendation, treatment documentation guidelines. Okay, I have no more questions at this time.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've got a follow-up. Talk a little bit about Dr. Denise Young. She's an associate of yours. She has entered into any contractual relationship with Collision Chiropractic, or would that have just been between Dr. Kim as co owner?
Kim is not a doctor.
Oh, Kim is not a doctor. Sorry.
Yeah.
Not a doctor. Would that have just been a contractual relationship between the two?
Just the two of us. Dr. Young was a salary employee.
Okay. And if I'm understanding the relationship, Dr. Denise worked most closely with him to treat these and get his.
Correct.
Dr. Knopf, what you may be seeing, and other members of the board may be curious as to this point as well, while we're speaking about Dr. Young, my understanding is she didn't have a separate agreement with Collision while she was working for Garden Lakes. Dr. Danielle could address whether or not she was aware of the arrangement or not, or if she was just provided with patients. So to the extent you're curious, I'm sure she's happy to answer that.
Yeah, we'll go with that as a follow-up. Is she aware that these were collision
patients,
yeah. And there was some protocol?
Right, yes, she was aware.
Did she see other patients too? Kind of collision chiropractic?
She did not. No, just
but it's that just thank you.
Another quick follow-up, if I may.
Yes, Dr. Bennett.
Those referrals that went to Dr. Young, did they go to Dr. Young via your relationship with Collision and Chiropractic, or did she have a separate relationship with Collision Chiropractic?
It was through us, through Garnley.
Okay, this is Dr. Green. So, I don't understand what your role in the office was. I started out on the staff thinking you were a treating provider, and now it's that work. So you have a 50-50 partnership for the clinic. How often were you supposed to show up to work, and what did you do?
Every day. Well, I was Garden Lakes Chiropractic for how many years? Since 2002. So I had my personal injury patients, my direct referrals. And so I tried to, it was almost like being two clinics in one. Especially when I did not want to continue with the contract and Kim LaFrance wanted to continue with the contract, it was almost like a separation where I was handling all Garden Lakes Chiropractic, Dr. Young was still seeing referrals through Collision Chiro. However, I was always there as for any medical questions, anything Dr. Young wanted to bounce off me, my expertise, my advice, my experience. She would ask me questions, medical questions, talking to her patients every day, and that's where we started to see she wasn't happy with what she was seeing, how the patients were being handled. So my role, I was there every single day.
You were treating patients related to
collision. Correct. Care. I had my own.
Yeah. So you hired on Dr. Denise Young when hired her.
She came on board June 2020.
Okay, so you were already a couple of years deep into the collision chiropractic.
Right.
And then you maybe got overwhelmed with work, patients, and then you hired her to help.
I had another associate prior to Dr. Denise Young, Dr. Pike, Dr. Ronald Pike. And previous to Dr. Pike, I had Dr. Benny Cosio, C-O-I-O.
Okay, and so did they all work on these collision chiropractic patients that were coming through?
Yes.
Okay, and so what was your relationship with, is this Dr. or Kim LaFrance or LaFrance?
LaFrance.
Okay, when did you or when did you develop a relationship with her? Was that prior to Collision Chiropractic or?
In 2002, when we started the clinic.
Okay. So, but I'm starting to glean from everything we've heard so far and reading some of the emails that we have here that she was involved in maximizing on some of these settlements and some of these. I'm looking at an exciting email from her that says, you know, this patient is a commercial policy with an explanation. And help run rides if needed. So how does a non-medical chiropractic person get involved in that? And about that, I understand she's a business owner, so she's thinking about profits and money. But what is her relation to reviewing any of these records and maybe working with Dr. Young and finding out that it's a commercial policy and then having this email communication to Dr. Papamathiakis that this is a commercial policy we can send for MRIs? You know, how does that, can you shed some light on that process?
I was not
the emailing back and forth, I wasn't aware of how much communication there was between Kim LaFrance and Dr. Mike. So most of the correspondence, let me just rephrase anything. So whenever, when I came back from being out of the country, everything was deleted. All the emails, all the internal documents were removed from the office. Everything was purposely deleted by Kim LaFrance.
And when was that?
That was June 13th of this year. And it was to prevent all of this.
I think just clarify, and I'll have that in the notes. From my understanding, she was not involved in the communication between Kim and Dr. Mike with respect to billing or the policies and things like that, since Kim was the relationship manager of that piece of things. Some of the email communications have only come to light to Dr. Danielle and been provided in the context of ongoing civil litigation. And as she has gathered that information via the civil process, she provided supplemental materials to the board in response to the complaint.
Thank you. Okay. So back to my earlier question. So Kim's role communicating with Dr. Mike and Collision Chiropractic and trying to identify with an opportunity to fill out for maybe services somewhere else, and including like, you know, the case where the patient who, you know, for MRI is just with Marie. Right.
My knowledge, yes.
And along those lines, in our materials, we had a headed up with a patient called initial. Looked like, you know, the patient had kind of dropped out of care, was feeling better, was looking back to work 6 days a week, working long hours, and at a point where they maybe weren't so symptomatic anymore. We don't have treatment records to back that up, but looking at the email communications, then it became this, okay, how do we manage this patient and get them for the MRIs that they need if they're getting better and they're not coming in anymore, you know, which is a horrible situation. So would you say that was typical, you know, with what was happening with patients where maybe they're getting better ahead of schedule and now you're getting intervention by physician chiropractic trying to press you to send out for shoulder MRIs and other studies that may or may not at that point?
And to this, and I wasn't hands-on with these patients, but every time Dr. Young would come to me with concerns, it was often enough for me to do something about it.
So was it your, did you get the sense that Dr. Young was at odds with Kim LaFrance and managing some of the patients, maybe where Dr. Young was ready to let the patient release from treatment, and you've got your business partner manager communicating with Dr. Ophthalmothiakis and play to try to increase the bill on some of these patients. Okay. So, any other questions for members?
One quick one. As we've noted, it is probably in every case, if not every case, I believe that the settlement of the case called for a dramatic reduction in the fees, and the nature of the contract was that reduction was determined by chiropractic and Dr. Pablo Mathiakis and his team. Correct so far?
That's correct.
Okay. And in those settlements, were you or your providers in your clinic provided with a breakdown of the settlement in terms of what other providers agreed to settle for?
No. That's just personal sheet.
So, for instance, there could have been other providers who, in the case, who did not settle or take a reduction in fees, but you were asked to take a reduction in fee. And is it your understanding of the law that a tacit pre-assumed reduction in fees is legal?
I was going to say, I don't know to the extent that that may call for a legal opinion, if she can actually specifically comment on that. She can and has said that she would provide a bill for these patients pursuant to the fee schedule that was established by Collision, and that it was solely up to Collision how much of that bill would be paid, and then pursuant to the contract, again, using Dr. Moreno's math, but I'm going to try to do numbers so that I don't have to try to divide 2,500 by half. If the bill was $2,000 and they settled for, Dr. Mike agreed to settle for $1,000, then pursuant to the contract, she would get $500. What other people may or may not have done in terms of reductions of their bills, she was not privy to that, from my understanding. Is that accurate? But I can say, without the specific situation, I think it's certainly routine in the personal injury industry that not only chiropractors but other providers do reduce bills because, say, for the sake of argument, somebody has a $15,000 policy to go around. It's not unheard. It's very common for providers and attorneys alike to reduce the amount of their bill in order to allow the patient to have a recovery, but it was not in Dr. Daniel's control.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the salient points here. In signing the contract, that control apparently was often agreed to. And the other issue, it's sort of, you know, we keep going around in a circle where a patient signs a lien saying they're fully responsible for all the care, but there's almost this tacit assumption we understand everybody's going to settle for some reduction. My understanding of that is it's illegal, and by the way, we can talk about that maybe later. But it's been my experience that every time that we've reviewed a reduction in fees because of some financial hardship, it was the reduction was not because we all agreed to do this in advance. It was because there was a financial hardship, and we are all of the providers and the attorney are sharing in that financial burden, and it's an agreed upon process, which apparently is not what occurred by virtue of the nature of the contract.
I think what was certain, Dr. Bennett, is the amount that she would receive of whatever the settlement was. I don't think the contract provided every time the bill will be reduced by 50% or 75% or whatnot. Obviously, there was an understanding that the bill would likely be reduced. I think I would venture to guess it would be extremely rare for someone to collect 100% of bill charges regardless of what type of provider they are. Even cash pay patients don't pay 100% of bill charges. But I don't think it was within the terms of the contract would automatically always be reduced. I think that was probably understood within the personal injury industry that a reduction would occur. What was certain was that the amount of the reduction would be determined by Collision, and then whatever amount Collision agreed to accept pursuant to the contract, she would receive 50%. So I don't believe it was every single one will be reduced regardless in terms of a contractual term. In terms of practicality, that's the nature of what happens in personal injury cases of Collision chiropractic. I'd be shocked if anybody collects 100% of bill charges.
Well, I can tell you for a fact that I have on many occasions. And so I know that it's not common. I mean, I know it's common, but that doesn't make it right, and it's an area of potential abuse. But the other point, and not to belabor too much longer, but what we have here is a situation where the entity that's providing all of the care that is under the purview of chiropractic care is removed from the process of agreeing how much is negotiated. And that's kind of the point I'm going to make.
Okay.
Absolutely, and that's one of the many issues that Dr. Lajeunesse ultimately determined was not appropriate and why she self-reported. And, you know, I would venture to guess that it probably wouldn't. I know that this board has already ordered for Dr. Mike and Collision to provide information with respect to contracts that they had with other providers. So I think it's isolated that this was widespread. And, again, Dr. Lajeunesse did the right but difficult thing by reporting to this board. And she's answering a lot of questions, but she's the one who deserves attention. And but for that, it would still be on and potentially is still going on with others. And we just ask that be mindful of that, that what she's done. Come at great personal sacrifice to her, and despite that, she wanted to do the right thing and let the board know about the situation.
Okay. One of our applications is from
That was an honest mistake. Honestly, it wasn't my intention to write no. I think I did not interpret the question appropriately. It was my belief that since I had not been yet called in front of the board, there was not a hearing, that there, I was under the impression that once there was a hearing and the board voted to move forward with an investigation, we were then.
I believe Investigator Dominic has a follow-up question, if the chair would consider that.
Yeah, I have a clarifying question. This is Ryan Dominic, the investigator. When a bill is settled, would you write off any portion of it?
That
meaning one.
Yeah.
If I may, if I understand, so we'll go back to easy math because I don't like math. There was a $2,000 bill. Collision accepted $1,000. You got $500. You write off the remaining $1,500 and just accept the $500.
Okay, so you would write off that Dr. Mike's portion as well. That was agreed upon in the contract?
Again, yes, but that would be more of a Kim LaFrance question because she handled the practice management and accounting.
From my understanding, there was not a balance bill to the patient. It was just this is full and final settlement of this bill.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we need to refer to the record and have a pass number.
I can't explain that. That's part of the thing that's being uncovered right now for case and so on. So I don't have any answers to that at this time. I'm looking into that.
Okay. A the date of that explanation of that. All right. So are there any other questions before we deliberate what we're going to do here?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a follow-up question? In the discussions that we've had, Ms. Lajeunesse, or Dr. Lajeunesse, we've had discussions around the 1099, and have you been able to produce those 1099s?
Again, all the files were removed from the office, so I don't have access to any of that.
But you do recall receiving the 1099 for each year?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Can you talk up just a little bit more about that? So you said that, well, first of all, is Kim LaFrance still working with you?
No, she's not.
And when did she leave?
When I changed the locks to the business.
So she's technically still a 50% owner, and you're trying to work through that. go with Dr. Young?
She is with Dr. Mike. I don't know to what extent, but as far as...
And Dr. Young left your office and opened up an office.
No, Dr. Mike opened up an office 1.4 miles from my clinic, and Dr. Young is his chiropractor, operating with my, I believe, two chiropractic assistants.
So, what's happening with what is from her?
We are in, we had a hearing yesterday. We're in the process of she wants a buyout. But honestly, with the harm she's done to the business, being with Dr. Mike, the retaliation, the mail forwarding, the deletion of thousands of emails and destroying evidence, having every single one of my staff members leave working for Dr. Mike, my associate doctor leaving, working for Dr. Mike. I was left just with one CA and myself, and it's just going through proving everything, and yeah, we're just going through the motions right now.
Okay.
As the kids say, it's complicated, but it's involved in ongoing litigation in terms of splitting the business interests, and I suspect, as most litigation does, it will be ongoing for quite some time.
Okay, so you had this clinic from 2002, had a bunch of patient files and information, and you went away on vacation, and you came back, and you're saying that all kinds of things were deleted. Can you be more specific about that? Did she destroy and delete your personal property for your patients that you were seeing? Or were these all collision chiropractic-related documents and patient records or closing documents?
Our patient records, because we're EMR, so everything's in the cloud, so our patient records are protected. However, it was all emails, anything that was on her computer, correspondence back and forth with Collision Chiro, anything that was on her computer in her office, which were the IT, the forensic IT professionals that I hired to retrieve. I mean, there was over close to 7,000 files.
Okay, so emails were deleted and payment information for tax receipts and that type of thing, or from Cairo, or what happened?
I don't know the extent of what was deleted. It's still being recovered right now. And it hasn't been given to me yet.
But it was related to Collision Chiropractic as opposed to her individual patients, and no patient records were deleted or destroyed.
Right. My patient records.
Were there any emails referencing patient care that you found?
Sure.
That were deleted, attempted to be deleted? All right.
Okay. So my question for my board members, do you feel like we have enough information to deal with this today? Do you think that a consent agreement staff to draft up would be appropriate and the investigation?
This is Dr. Mike. If I could, I'd like to make a couple comments as well.
You know what? You're not allowed to comment, Dr. Mike. Not your day. Do you feel like there's more information that we need to get from Dr. Lejeunesse?
I'd like to go into any executive session.
Make a motion to go into executive session.
For legal advice?
For legal advice. Of course.
I'll second.
Right after the executive session, those in favor signify by saying aye.
All right.
Aye.
Opposed. Ratified by Sabbath. And so we're going to go into executive session. We're going to leave the room. We'll be back in a little bit. Before, hopefully you can hear me. Patience with that. I want to hear from Kim LeBron. I see you are on the Chiropractic.
Yes, I'm so sorry. This is Kim LaFrance.
Hi. Welcome, Dr. Richard Carino.
Yes.
So we're going to, in all likelihood, continue this to another day, but I wanted to know if you have anything you'd like to say at this point.
I do. I do want to say something to honorable board members. My name is Kim LaFrance. I am the business partner of Danielle Lajeunesse, 50% owner, president, and a patient of hers. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to say these things. And I would answer any questions in order for the board to better understand what is happening here. I believe it's important, first, to state that Dr. Danielle has numerous chiropractic board complaints, and I believe she's a danger to the public. Dr. Danielle has had numerous affairs with patients in a current relationship with Trisha Bowie.
Hold on. We're not going to entertain any kind of defaming comments here.
Okay.
I need to be very specific about what you've heard today.
Okay. Number one, I feel that Dr. Danielle Lajeunesse is not being truthful about the patient referrals. I actually sent the referrals out. All my emails are in place. I have been ousted. I can't have any access to any of the business files or emails to even show you that they're still there. I did not delete any regarding emails. I've been doing this job for 21 years in regards to Collision patients and Garden Lakes patients. No emails are deleted unless they're finished. You know, occasionally it'd be just something that you can get rid of because you know it's taken care of. I also believe that she was not truthful about Dr. Young because she did demand that Dr. Young see Garden Lakes patients as well as Collision, and I'm a witness to that. And about the 1099s that you were requesting, she has all of them. She has all the 1099s, and unfortunately, I gave her photocopies of all of the taxes, the 1099s, but I have no proof of that because I literally handed her those copies. I should have done it through an email to protect myself, but I had trust in her. So getting back to the emails, none of them were deleted. And I'm not a doctor. I had no involvement as far as referrals other than sending out the referral forms to Dr. Young or any of the previous doctors that were an associate of Dr. Danielle's. I have no direction in that whatsoever. I am not a doctor. I've never pretended to be a doctor. I carried this business to 2017 when she was finally put on the Articles of Organization. So I carried that business from 2002 to 2017 without her actually on the business legally. I've been ousted. I've been humiliated. I have asked for a buyout since 2020 because I could see her devious manner coming forward and I was scared to death. There's been fee splitting that I'm aware of. We did it 10 years ago. There was a board complaint in regards to that. I believe it was 2016, but I'm not quite sure. She was fee splitting with a naturopath. Providing free space to the personal injury clinic in order to receive 24 personal injury referrals. I have more, but I'm not sure how far you want me to go with this.
Just want relevant testimony as to what you've heard already today.
I'm so sorry, what was that?
So if there is any testimony that you've heard today that you didn't agree with, that's what I want you to comment on.
Okay, which I have. I made 4 points to this.
All right. Thanks, board members. Any questions?
You said from 2002 to 2017 that she was not even on the business. What business?
Garden Lakes Chiropractic.
So who owns Garden Lakes Chiropractic?
I did.
Solely?
I'm sorry?
You were the sole owner of Garden Lakes Chiropractic?
Yes. Yes, I was the sole.
You said you've been working for collision chiropractors for 20 years?
No, Garden Lakes Chiropractic. I'm sorry if I misspoke. Yeah.
So how long did you work for collision chiropractic, or did you not work for collision chiropractic?
I did not work for collision chiropractic. I only instrumented emails for the treating physician, which Dr. Elijah has not treated any collision patients, I believe, since 2018. We always had an associate doctor. The only tool I was in sending referrals out for the doctors in need of the patient. And it was never directly to a specific place. It was just the diagnosis need for the patient. I was just a tool.
Referrals to who?
Okay, so the doctors that were treating collisions, I'm sorry, I'm just a little bit nervous, but the patients that were being treated by our associate doctor would come to me and say, hey, can this patient needs a referral for an MRI. They need a medical doctor on board to help them get through the beginning of their care. They need an ortho. So I would just merely email what the doctor gave, and we always attached records to show the patient needed that care, that specific care.
So you made the referral based on the associate doctor saying they needed a referral?
Yes.
You decided you should go see. Is that correct?
What was that last part?
You decided which doctor they would go see, who you'd refer them to.
No.
Made that decision?
No, not at all. I make no decisions. I am not a doctor.
Who made the decision as to which doctor they would go to when they needed a referral? That's my question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Collision would.
Collision would.
Yes.
I have no other questions.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Bennett.
Yes, this is Dr. Wayne Bennett, Ms. LaFrance. On that same vein, did you, in the capacity of making the referrals you just talked about, make referrals to MedRoyal?
Me personally?
In your capacity, making referrals for the patients in Garden Lakes Chiropractic, did you facilitate referrals to MedRoyal?
Yes.
And can you give me a ballpark percentage of how many of the patients for whom you made referrals were referred to MedRoyal?
Well, just to be clear, I'm guessing. I don't have an accurate number for you, but I would say the patients that needed a medical doctor on board because they didn't have their own MD, I would say about 30%, but I can't be totally sure of that.
Let me restate my question. I'm not asking about how many patients were sent to medical doctors or who needed a medical doctor. I'm asking, of the referrals that you made from Garden Lakes Chiropractic, collision chiropractic patients, about what percentage were referred to MedRoyal?
Okay. I would say about 30%, but I'm guessing at this point. I'm not specifically sure.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay.
Any response? I'll be incredibly brief. As I think the board has heard, Ms. LaFrance just acknowledged that acted as the go-between between the providers who were being seen by Dr. Young, the collision chiropractic patient, and collision chiropractic, i.e. Dr. Mike, in terms of referral. She's saying as a medical doc, she's not a medical doctor, so she didn't decide that they needed a referral, but she's acknowledging to this board that it, when the provider would say, this person needs an MRI, she would send that referral to collision, i.e. Dr. Mike, and Dr. Mike would then decide to whom that person was seen for those services, which was presumably someone who was also involved in collision chiropractic. So I think everything else aside, that confirms what Dr. Lajeunesse has said in terms of the go-between. Lastly, with respect to the deletion of emails and whatnot. I think to a degree that's a collateral issue, but it was raised by us and by Dr. Lajeunesse because there's information that she's not privy to, but as it became within her possession in the context of ongoing litigation, to the extent it was relevant to the board's inquiry, that's how it's been provided. She's happy to address any other questions, but Ms. LeBrant stated is essentially confirming what Dr. Lajeunesse had already told this board today.
Okay, thank you. Board members, welcome to
the Chairman, I would move that we continue this case and in the meantime pursue a couple of things. I think we should direct the board to continue their dialogue with regard to a disciplinary consent agreement as outlined by staff to us. And also we should request the information harvested from the forensic audit. And finally, we should subpoena Ms. LaFrance, Dr. Young, Drs. Mike Pike, and Cosillo for dialogue and questioning relative to this matter.
Okay. Second.
Second motion.
Okay.
No, just a point of clarification real quick. In regards to negotiating the consent agreement, is there anything that outside of what the staff had already provided that you wanted added or taken away?
In my opinion, I really am basically interested in just keeping it under consideration.
Okay.
I believe that we may or may not. I don't think we know enough.
Okay, perfect.
So I think that we may or may not modify it, but I just want to keep it on the table
okay. As
an option.
Okay, I'm going to call for this question.
Aye.
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 Okay, hearing none. We have this one applicant, so for right to have it, we'll come back on another day and we'll have some work.
Thank you.
Okay, board members, we're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll do six right now, so let's get everybody back a little. Good, can you hear me now? Buddy? Audience, give me a head nod if you can hear me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. You can hear me, yes?
Can you hear us?
Okay, the time is 11:08. We're back in regular session. We are on the next tab, which is tab number 5, in the matter of Dr. Arthur Mejia.
Still me. good morning, members of the board. Mandy Carvis of Wicker Smith appearing on behalf of my client, Dr. Mejia, who I believe is virtually appearing today. He's currently muted, so we may have to provide him with instructions to unmute to introduce himself.
Okay. Dr. Mejia, can you please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record? Perfect.
Mejia?
Yes. Let me fix my screen here. Okay.
Hi. Jarvis or Ms. Vanderbeam?
The investigative facts are patient abandonment, failure to complete continuing education, but board staff is asking you to dismiss that allegation. Failure to maintain adequate records, and then to add violation of a board order and making false statements.
Yes, Dr. Reno, members of the board.
As the board is aware, I was not representing Dr. Mejia at the time of the initial submission to the board. I was retained subsequently, so I was not representing him at the time of the original board order with respect to completion of the EBAS exam and provision of additional records. It's my understanding that Dr. Mejia did provide the additional records when requested by the board. However, as a result of reviewing those records, the board staff has expressed some concerns with respect to the record keeping. With respect to the portion of the EBAS that has not yet been completed, I'll allow Dr. Mejia to address that. He has taken and completed four parts, but still needs to complete professional boundaries, and will certainly take care of that promptly. Dr. Mejia and I intend to communicate with the board staff with respect to potential consent agreement to address the issues primarily relating to record-keeping. Continuing education is being requested, which we would believe is certainly appropriate in the circumstance. I don't know if the amount of the hours being requested in addition to the normal continuing education is necessary, but obviously he would comply with whatever this board believes is necessary. Given the original nature of the complaint, we would certainly agree that the 6 hours of continuing ed for special populations in chiropractic, the female patients, I know that amended that in other matters, and other clients have certainly found that to be beneficial in information in that respect. Obviously, if this board believes that a total of 30 hours of continuing education is required, he would comply with that. I would like to work with board staff with respect to monitoring and audits just to refine and understand what that is. But again, I would let and request Dr. Mejia address whether or not there was any sort of confusion on his part with respect to the EBAS exam, and he's happy to answer any other questions that the board members may have since he appeared before you last.
Thank you.
Dr. Mejia, can you hear?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me, Dr. Mejia?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Sure. Dr. Mejia, can you just address the EBAS and the failure to fully comply with what the board had requested?
I might be mistaken, but I thought I completed all four parts, what was required of me.
And can you explain how you believe that you did all parts of the EBAS?
I have my passing score from the, you know, from them.
Okay. Are you aware there are 5 parts?
No, I guess I was mistaken. I thought there were only 4.
Okay. And what was the basis for that belief?
Just what I reviewed from the you know, from the summons.
Okay. No further questions from me.
Yeah, Dr. Mejia, this is Dr. Knopf. One of the issues that we can maybe clear up quickly here, hopefully, is that under you might say you're not under investigation for a board complaint. Can you explain that, please?
Would you repeat that? I apologize.
So on your renewal application for 2023 mm-hmm. relicensure, you said that you're not under review for a board complaint right now, when in fact you are. Can you explain why you marked no?
I guess that was a poor choice. I thought maybe after complete, when I thought that I completed my ethics exams, so I thought maybe that I was out of the woods with the problem.
So let me just repeat that back to you. You're breaking up a little bit. Make sure I understood it. Your understanding was because you'd completed what you thought was all parts of the EBAF successfully, you thought that you were no longer being investigated by the board.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions I have for now.
I have no questions.
Okay. Dr. Bennett?
Dr. Mejia, hello. I'm Dr. Wayne Bennett.
Hello.
Good day to you. So when we last talked, we had discussed the nature of your record keeping, and at the time you stated that the records that we were reviewing were quite old and that in the interim you had undertaken significant efforts to upgrade your records, record keeping protocols. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Subsequent to that, we asked for some of those records that were more recent.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I thought.
And we have had the opportunity to review those records. And while I'm prepared to go into very specific detail on the deficiencies of those records, I just, in general, would say to you that your records are just as bad now as they were in 2014, if not worse, specifically with regard to the manner in which you document evaluation and management or lack thereof of your patients. What response do you have to that?
Well, I've always understood that my records, I designed my forms, and they've reflected what the National Board of Chiropractic Examiners has required from us. And I have what Arizona requires from me, a health history, a clinical impression, exam findings, diagnostic results, progress notes, treatment plan, and billing record. All those components I felt were there. Maybe the treatment plan had to be interpreted from the SOAP notes, but that's because I have a very simple treatment plan.
Okay. Well, clearly we have a very different perception of what appropriate records are. I would tell you that in one patient's records, patient SM, these are records that were 4 visits per page, handwritten and illegible. There was the doctor was not identified anywhere in the record. In no functional outcome assessments or re-exams were performed on the patient in over 200 visits. And that's just one example. Sir, your records are very subpar and do not conform to record-keeping standards by any stretch of the imagination. And so what I'm understanding you're saying is that you just disagree. You think your records are fine.
Well, I thought they were at least competent and legible and large. Yeah, I'm a little confused.
Apparently. Okay, I have no further questions.
Okay. Do we have the complainant with the initial MK present? All right, so we're not just what we're doing here. We have an added violation of it by way of court order. And then
if I could make a comment, it was also added for what he said in the last meeting with his records being far better than the ones that you were looking at as well.
But for clarification, that continuing education is all set. So. The patient abandonment issue that I have a problem with.
No basis to proceed for that on that allegation. Yeah, we have before us a recommended we have a before us a proposed probationary consent agreement, which would be disciplinary in nature. Recommendations consist of 2 years of probation, a practice monitor who would sign off on records for each patient seen to verify that they meet the minimum standard in Arizona. And after 1 year and by written request from the practice monitor, the board may terminate the practice monitor. Quarterly record audits of at least 10 patient files to be no more than 6 months old. A total of 30 hours of continuing education, 12 of which are associated with record keeping and documentation. Clearly, that would be, there's very clearly a need for a whole reset on this doctor's concept of what an appropriate record is. 6 hours of continuing education on special populations in chiropractic with regard to the female patients. Stipulations at the first 15, and then 6 hours of patient management, 6 hours of ethics and boundaries. The first 15 are to be completed within 90 days, second 15 to be completed within 1 year, in addition to the 12 hours of required license renewal. There would be no clause for early termination, and if not signed, then would be forwarded to formal interview within 30 days. I think that those issues address what we have uncovered here. And so I would move that we direct the board to proceed with a negotiation of that consent agreement.
Including the 30 hours?
Yes.
Okay.
And the motion?
How many days is signed? I apologize. How many days is signed?
30.
And it's not signed?
Move forward to formal hearing.
Formal interview? Thank you.
And seek one point of clarification that the board may wish to clarify as well. We've now established that Dr. Mejia thought that he took and passed all portions of the EBAS, but he has not taken the remaining portion. He still needs to take the professional boundaries part. I think obviously he wants to do that and comply with this board's prior order. Do we want to address, and I don't know how quickly or not quickly he can register for that, but I didn't know if we wanted to separately re-instruct him to do so outside of the consent agreement, because that's an existing board order that he clearly wants to comply with.
I think two parts, the five-part board order.
One.
One?
Yes.
Okay.
We could direct him to take that final part to comply, and you could extend the interim order that he's currently under and allow him to take that last part.
If you extend the interim order, then he wouldn't be in violation of the order.
And the reason that I would be putting that forth is I do think it was unintentional on his part that part was not completed. He obviously took and passed the other section, so I would request that he be given the opportunity to complete the last part and not be found in violation, because I think it was unintentional. And then obviously we would still address the consent agreement, because that primarily relates to the record-keeping issues. So just so that it's cleaner for everyone.
My comment would be that the reason why we ordered the ethics and the EBAS at the preliminary stage was to determine if there was justification or suspicion of need for disciplinary action. I believe that course has already left the barn. We already know there's need for disciplinary action. And so I'm indifferent as to whether or not that part is even needed.
In my view, he's already violated the board's order. It's up to him to get himself into compliance, and I'm not sure we need to waive non-compliance. It's up to him. And maybe in the consent agreement, there's some language that notes, you know, we're not superseding any prior board order.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a first and a second.
Just an additional comment here before that, sorry. The practice monitor signing off on records for each patient seen to verify that they meet the minimum standard in Arizona. I'm not familiar with us having taken an action similar to that in the past. Is that typical? Is that
onerous, especially if we're asking for a quarterly record audit where we will see if the care was deemed necessary or not within that audit itself.
I think you can leave it up to the monitor. That, you know, the board-approved monitor could, you know, you could leave it up to them as to, you know, what they want to do aside from the chart audit.
Because, yeah. I mean, is this another chiropractor that's going to be making the determination that care is appropriate? Is it a layperson?
It's a monitor. It'd be a chiropractor.
Okay.
Yeah. The monitors are always practitioners.
So
But you can leave it up to their discretion on how many records to review. And, again, they will be providing a report quarterly. So that can be baked in there.
Yeah, if it's not every patient, that feels...
It might be a little onerous. You're right.
So I would say just put a number on that.
But I would say leave it open to the monitor.
Okay.
It's what they do professionally.
And Alyssa and I have had a conversation that maybe the quarterly audits start happening after a year. So once the monitor is no longer there, so when they're doing the record audit, it could be records that he's doing versus auditing records that potentially the practice monitor is also signing off on.
The practice monitor would be the one providing the quarterly audits.
Well, and
it would be one and the same.
Okay.
That would be, just for clarification, they would be conducting the quarterly audit, then we're saying it's 10 patient files to be more than 6 months old. That's that individual. On top of that, we would ask them to review for patients seen to verify they meet the minimum standard, and we can set a number for that so it's not every patient, because that feels above and beyond.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, when the monitor is auditing, they do 10% of the total. Every new patient, 10%. A minimum.
10%.
Is that friendly to the first and second?
Yeah, I think that our instructions were to direct staff to negotiate, and I think that they can do so based upon the dialogue that we've had, so I don't think that there's anything.
Yeah, you might need to work out the, because now I'm thinking about it, if it takes them longer than 30 days to take the violation, and we are essentially waiving that by not forwarding it to a formal interview, right?
No, you're already taking action on the CA that he violated the court order.
Okay. Well, but then do we want part of this consent agreement to be to take that final portion?
Yeah, you can do that.
Maybe add that to the consent agreement by within however many
days. 90 days.
90 days.
What I heard, Dr. Bennett, correct me if I'm wrong, you were indifferent because that window has come and gone. And so let's start with what we have today, looking at what had happened previously, and this would be the new consent. Let's leave that section out.
That was my
yeah.
Point, yes.
I agree, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so we need a roll call vote. I'll the question.
No, it's just, you're just authorizing us to negotiate a consent agreement.
Yeah, you're not deciding on it.
Not deciding on anything.
Because it'll come back to you.
Aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed?
Okay,
hearing none,
the
motion carries.
Thank you, Scarborough. You're done with me for the day.
Okay, we're going to move on to staff number 6, the matter of...
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
Second.
Everybody say aye.
Aye.
Aye. We have 5 ayes headed into executive session. The time is 11:29. So, I think we will be absolutely. Okay, the time is 11:39. We are back in open session.
Gentlemen, I'd like to recuse myself from this case as I am the one who wrote a letter of reference or recommendation for Mr. Lazara.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Solomon.
You have a memo from Investigator Dominic regarding a continuing education course that was submitted by Mr. Lazara for the Lazara Advanced Injury Seminar, Jurisprudence, Documentation, Case Management, and Symptomology. And I would just like to kind of say that in terms of things that we are working through in the board, CEs has been a challenge and is maybe not our cleanest process, to be completely honest. And I think as a board, we have not communicated necessarily exactly what we wanted and need from applicants, and that through the various iterations of executive directors, things have changed, and we've stepped away from rules and changed rules and interpreted them differently. And so with that, this wasn't about being punitive. This was really about kind of level setting, figuring out exactly what we need, and whether or not this course, the sections, not necessarily the entire seminar, but just certain portions, if as an attorney teaching on traumatic brain injury, if he was actually qualified to do that, but to the extent of not whether or not he could teach it, but rather as a CE, doesn't meet the requirements for your population of licensees. And that determination is all that board staff is asking for today.
Okay, thank you. Sara, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Dr. Garino, I can't hear you. If you don't mind talking into the mic, that would be great.
Turn if there's something off the mic. Do we have a sound manager?
Maybe this one works better.
Hello, hello, hello.
Oh, much better. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So, board members, do you have any questions?
Comments?
The question becomes whether or not Mr. Lazara has the knowledge and skills associated with the ability to instruct the content under question. And we have a reference from a board member who specifically has stated an opinion on that subject, and so I would like to hear from her.
Okay. Ms. Powell? Can you kindly unmute yourself and announce your name for the record?
Thank you. Angela Powell. I have done extensive background check on Larry Lazara, because when I first met him, I thought that the class that he was teaching, although content was good, the syllabus was lacking seriously, as were almost every of the syllabi I was reviewing at the time. So I approached him on a few issues. He was more than receptive and open and said, hey, whatever I need to do, teach me. And I did help him, as I did the other doctors that I was working with who were preparing syllabi. He has not only graduated law school at the age of, 23, but went on to a second law school for the elites, probably you know something about this, Seamus, in litigation. And educational background in things like neurology and orthopedics, patient care, traumatic brain injuries. I listened to his seminar the first time. I was very impressed. He doesn't teach the whole seminar. He has specialists or experts come and teach most of the courses. So he's not teaching necessarily a class on neurology. He does an intro to it and then brings on the expert like he did with me in record keeping and documentation. So I've never seen anywhere where he wasn't qualified or any subject matter that, even with my limited knowledge, that I didn't understand, to make it very understandable, and that wasn't accurate, except for one time when a doctor who was just out in left field made some comments about him not being a doctor, so he's not qualified to teach. Don't necessarily have to be a doctor to be qualified to teach. An expert in the field sometimes isn't always a doctor, but courses are taught by specialists. So
his background is something he can tell you more about if you want to ask, you know, ask him to explain it to you. But I did do the background on him, and he was qualified to teach those courses. That's why I wrote the letter.
Just one point of clarification. I understand what Ms. Powell is saying regarding the specialist teaching, but when the application came through, he's listed as the only provider, which kind of goes back to my statement, is I don't think we've really clarified or done a good job adhering to the standard of what's needed in those CE applications, and I think that's where some of the confusion is coming in, and just want to address that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Powell.
I have a question.
May I make just one more comment? That's very true, what Ms. Vanderveen is saying. There have been different interpretations. And when I was reviewing some of these way back when, the course was under a person's name, but as long as you had the instructors all approved by the board, they could teach the courses for them, and that was the interpretation. So that could have been my fault.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Bennett?
Yes, quick question. And it's directed, I believe, to either Ms. Powell or staff. But the question is whether – it's not a question of whether or not speakers during the course of the curriculum, if they're approved for teaching the content or whatever they are, that's not the issue. The issue is presentations that are actually provided by Mr. Lozera himself speaking words from his mouth. Is that the case? Is that the issue here?
I think it's actually both. If we receive the application and the only instructor listed is Mr. Lozera, but
it's presumed in the,
right, so then he's speaking to all the content, and that we don't have the subsequent list of instructors, much like the panel that's included, as who those individuals are in their license verifications. So that piece is missing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of both.
Yeah, and I wanted to get to the second part, but I wanted to establish this part first. And so I would, Mr. Lozera, my question to you would be, and I should also, just for sake of disclosure, I too have instructed courses that were sponsored by Mr. Lozera, and I've not been compensated for those or anything. I don't have a financial relationship with him with regard to that in any sense. But I feel fully confident in making an objective decision here, so just for the record. And so, Mr. Lozera, when you are presenting material yourself, not by someone else in your presentations, are you how much of that is your opinion about the material? How much of it is actually specifically with regard to things not within the scope of practicing law, but within the scope of correlating the practice of law to a human anatomy? How much of what you are saying do you endeavor to provide specific references from rather than rendering your opinion?
Okay. I don't render opinions on this particular segment of the traumatic brain injury. So if you don't mind, I'd like to give a little bit of background on what the actual subject matter of my presentation is and how it ties into the medical legal presentation that I put on. So first of all, as an attorney, I'm obligated, ER 1.1, to be competent with respect to personal injuries. That's what personal injury attorneys do, is we advocate on behalf of our patients based on the nature, duration, and extent of the injuries. We also have to value those injuries based on the information that's presented. We are required to become educated on all types of injuries, including whiplash. You know, the objection to some of the information that I'm providing, it's basic information, by the way, symptoms of a TBI, it's more catered towards documentation. But objecting to the presentation that I put together would be the equivalent of objecting to me talking about whiplash, which is every case that I have, and I've done thousands of them. I've handled hundreds of concussion cases. I'm required to read medical documentation, consult with neurologists, consult with neuropsychologists. I just want to show you something real quick. This is a neurolaw manual specific to for lawyers to advocate traumatic brain injuries. Just in this one document alone, we are educated on analyzing causes of injury, nature of injury, extent of injury, investigating the extent of the injuries with specialists, documentation, the effect of traumatic brain injuries. All of this stuff is I've been formally educated on. I've taken psychology courses. I took law classes on mental health and the law. I even sat through medical continuing education courses specific to traumatic brain injuries. I've sat through neuroradiologist presentations on the identification of traumatic brain injuries with MRIs. I also, my presentation, I gave it to Dr. Shia, Luai Shia, who's a neurologist, actually pending approval right now before the board for his course. I believe your investigator has a letter from him confirming that the information that's in my presentation, it's basically textbook items that you can open a book and list. It's very similar to me documenting the Cross guidelines. You open the, specifically the aggravating factors. You open the Cross book and there's the list of aggravating factors. So to say I'm not qualified or competent, this is incorrect because I have to deal with this information on a daily basis and I have to advocate on my client's behalf, talking about the brain injuries, the what the documentation says. And my presentations are legal medical, not all medical. So it's the purpose of my presentations are to bridge the gap between the medical field and the legal field. So that's why it's an advanced injury seminar. It's tailored to personal injury cases where your side has to document and give us the ammunition we need in order to effectively advocate on behalf of our patients. So I've gone through all of the legal medical education that's required in order to make me competent in order to do so. I've also had advanced training in how to litigate these types of cases, even examine the specialists. So with that in mind, the details that are in my presentation more cater to documenting. So the identification of what the traumatic brain injury symptoms are, and that has to get it, make its way into the medical records where we justify a referral, and that's when we bring in a neurologist to do a neuro evaluation. So everything in my presentations are medical, legal, and how we can bridge the gap in terms of documentation so I can effectively negotiate settlements with insurance companies. I'm not trying to teach people how to practice medicine. I'm simply stating facts to be aware of when doing documentation. I would never try to teach somebody on how to do a neurological evaluation or how to adjust or anything like that. My information is purely academic.
So this is Dr. Dorino, and I appreciate that. And I think that's why we're here, and I want to applaud staff for bringing this to our attention. But in effect, as an attorney, you have two topics that are looking for credit for relicensing that are our medical chiropractic topics, and that's the traumatic brain injury and the psychological injuries. What you just told us is that it's more for record keeping purposes and documentation. And so I think if they were under that umbrella, it would be easier for staff to approve it rather than as a devil's advocate here, I feel like we're opening up the door to people who don't have chiropractic licenses to do continuing education on healthcare related topics. And I don't even know where that will lead. My question is, for Mr. Monahan, like, is there anything in the statute that would prevent, somebody from us approving these courses the way that they're listed? And we've got copies, but I'm not an attorney, and so I don't know where we are with that.
You're asking if there's anything in statute that, based on his application, that wouldn't allow him?
Yeah, based on his training. I mean, he's saying I've done the training and I've taken these classes and I'm quoting from this book, but he's not a licensed healthcare provider offering continuing education on healthcare-related topics.
Yes. Well, and I can tell you, so the basic requirements under your rule, under 801B, so the basic requirements, the primary consideration in determining whether or not a specific course not the individual, but the course qualifies as acceptable continuing education is that it must be a formal program of learning which will contribute directly to the professional competence of a licensee in the practice of chiropractic. Each course shall be on the subject of clinical benefit to the consumer of chiropractic services. So your other threshold question is, does the public benefit from this course, from the doctor taking this course?
Mr. Chairman, there's a second part of that statute that talks about the instructor's qualifications. So shouldn't we be addressing that more? Then we know that subject matter has to be, we've got that, but is he qualified is the question, right?
It's both.
Okay, so
the course has to be beneficial to the consumer of chiropractic services.
So,
Mr. Turbinson, do you have any clarity?
I can, reading the course goals and objectives, it definitely goes beyond the record keeping and presentation. It discusses how to identify and learn and monitor symptoms of traumatic brain and psychological injuries. And Mr. Lazar, you just don't have a medical license to be able really to opine on that in a way that, in my opinion, would be effective for a listener or an attendee where you'd have a back and forth. You'd be able to point to a book. But, you wouldn't be able to provide that additional dialogue that is the whole point of continuing education is to stay on topics with that. And so I think, in my opinion, you certainly are well qualified for jurisprudence and record keeping, but I would really be concerned with starting to have people who, just do a lot of, this isn't you, but the whole thing of I watch a lot of medical shows on TV. I know a lot of stuff about that. That's almost, the slippery slope that we'd be going down. And, I do a lot of semiconductor work as an attorney, but no one's hiring me to be a professor at ASU to teach semiconductors. It's just, I could give you a bunch of materials, but I'm not going to be the one who's on the cutting edge of that stuff. And so I think a similar purpose kind of is being served by having a gatekeeping function that, have doctors, licensed doctors, be the ones to be providing this medical knowledge and education.
Sure. May I ask a couple of quick questions? If I tailor the presentation on traumatic brain injury specific to documentation and record keeping, where I detail what the symptoms of a concussion are, like the basic stuff, is that permissible? Would that be covered?
I'm gonna look to staff for clarification on that.
I think it would be, but then I think we would have to be very careful to delineate from what's listed in subsection L, which are courses that are not qualified, which are legal courses other than pre-approved board jurisprudence. So kind of walking that fine line of the documentation as it relates, as kind of Seamus stated, that benefits the consumer and improves that versus how do we make sure we have, great cases, which I think is where we are.
Sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think it is important, if we do look at L, I don't know if anybody's actually looked at L yet, but it says the following subject shall not qualify for continuing education for the purpose of renewal. Malpractice defense, practice management, risk management, promotion of a product or service, strategies to increase insurance payment, administrative or economic aspects of practice, legal courses other than those approved or jurisprudence, motivational courses, anti-aging, hormone treatment, aromatherapy, stress management, HIPAA, homeopathic considerations, and that's about it. So, Dr. Knopf, and then we'll come back to Dr. Bennett.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as it relates to what is the benefit to the consumer, I believe there is a benefit to the chiropractic consumer here, and that these attorneys and doctors work as advocates to get them reimbursed appropriately for the injuries that occur. So I think there is that link there that's clear in my mind. So I kind of moved past that requirement, which
the person being qualified to teach it. And I think from what I'm understanding with Dr. Guarino is I'm in the same boat for saying that if he's tailoring it to documentation, case review, even of here's what's come before in previous court cases, this is what went well, this is what was missed, this is the information that was needed, I'm okay with that. But as soon as we get into the clinical space around how to diagnose, that's where I start to get a little more leery, like Mr. Chairman said.
Dr. Bennett.
Yeah, I did look at Section L, and I had the same questions, and I agree with Dr. Knopf, and I believe that I can speak from a reasonably well-informed position because the interface between the law and actual healthcare, that space is where health-impacting decisions are made that do speak to the benefit to the patient and impact the patient's life. And so there isn't a clean, clear line. And oftentimes, the documentation of care, the quality of the documentation of care, and whether the doctor goes through the rubric to address clinically relevant issues is the difference that it can make a very large difference, not just in terms of money, but in terms of outcome for the patient, and therefore speaks to patient safety. I have chosen to teach classes on that topic because I believe very strongly that understanding the role of a physician in a med legal environment is critical to the benefit of the patient. And so my opinion is in direct concurrence with Dr. Knopf that when we talk about documentation, we talk about compliance and case studies, and also documentation, but also compliance. Are you in compliance with treatment guidelines? And here's what's happened in a med legal environment, and those kinds of things would be relevant to continuing education. And so the flaw that I see here is that it creates the issue that we're dealing with, because I've seen the content of the courses. What Mr. Lazara is saying is the case, but the presentation of the content of the course may need to be revised to reflect documentation, compliance, those kinds of clinical issues from an administrative point of view where he can speak from a position of authority.
And it cannot include legal aspects. It's very specific. The board shall not approve legal courses other than the jurisprudence examination.
Okay.
But it has to be medical.
It would fall under record keeping. Any presentation on this stuff. And that's,
I'm just making sure that we articulate that.
So I don't know, we're working close to belaboring the point, and I would like to move, if we could, to the other issue of the panel, because I agree that if a panel discussion is provided on a continuing education environment, continuing education environment, the credentials and the qualifications of the people who are on the panel should be part of the syllabus for the continuing education. So I think that's just something that we should, get acknowledged on the record. And
it's also a requirement under 801. All instructors that will be on that panel have to have certain information, a list of items sent to the board.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think it's good for visibility and transparency into the presenters. It holds the continuing ed provider accountable to keeping a consistent panel and not just rotating individuals who we may not agree with on that topic.
Can I just ask for a point of clarification? And if I need to bring this item back, we can add it to next month's agenda. But I think in terms of continuing education, one of the things that I've started to see is we do seminars and things like this, and we just take pre-approved courses and plug them in and not submit them for reapproval as part of the seminar, and then edits and changes occur to those presentations, and they don't mirror up to what we've approved, which is where I think some of this, as I've said, like, we haven't been real consistent. And so back to the panel, but some of the discussion about the panel was, oh, they already provide courses, so they're already approved by the board. And so back to your point, is that's why a complete application would be considered all of those resumes, all of those letters, the license verifications need to be resubmitted.
Well, if there were a panel, let's say there's a three-person panel, one's good on impairment rating, one's good on documentation, the other is good on, I don't know, orthopedic evaluation. And if the panel discussion were on the subject of general clinical management, and each of those three providers had those credentials for those continuing education, it would make sense to me that you wouldn't have to re-credential that whole seminar if those instructors were speaking on the subject that they were already authorized to provide continuing education for.
I understand what you're saying, but then I think this is how we get back here where we don't know. Like, I don't know. We don't know who's on the panel because that wasn't what was submitted.
What I'm saying is if the seminar was scheduled and they said we're going to have these three doctors, Dr. A, B, and C, speaking on a panel discussion relative to their area of expertise, then the submission for that particular seminar would contain that information, and it seems that should be sufficient without having to re-credential the content of what they have accreditation for that seminar, which I think is what I'm hearing you say, or maybe I'm not hearing you correctly.
I'm saying it from the aspect of not necessarily re-credentials, but resubmit to it as a packet for a panel, because we're just saying they're teaching another course that you've already approved, and we're going to put them on this panel. But we don't know who they are based on how the application came in.
Per the statute and rule, every application has to be accompanied by a curriculum vitae for each person that's going to be on the panel, regardless of whether they've been approved for another course. Each one has to have that. The application isn't complete with that.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, we just do that. Am I missing something?
that seems to request that, but
maybe you could put on the form of the request.
I'm pretty sure I submitted my CV with the application.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're talking about the panel, people on the panel.
Oh, I'm sorry. And then for the record, to the board, this particular seminar that was submitted was just a culmination of past seminars that had already been approved by the board. So there's nothing new that I haven't presented in the past that hasn't already been approved. I'm just commingling it into one larger seminar. So there's absolutely nothing new in the application that I submitted. I'm simply merging past seminars.
Not going to pull that past application to determine if the current application and structure is correct. So
right.
I mean, I think it's just an easy thing here. Every application renewal, I mean, we don't allow people to renew their licenses and not submit continuing education certificates, right, or an affidavit. So I think it's just got to be complete. You have to comply with the rule under 801.
Well, let me be clear. If I decide that I want to put on a seminar that's going to feature four different presenters, and each of those presenters are going to speak on a topic that they've already had continuing education approval for to teach themselves, what do I have to provide for that specific presentation in terms of application?
Everything that's in 801 is required under that application.
It really should be considered a new application and given a new course number for that seminar.
Yeah.
Just because I think what you're trying to say, and this is confusing, just because an instructor's been approved already to teach whatever, and you put together a new seminar, even if all of those subject matters have been approved as separate seminars or separate CE hours, when you pull it all together to create a new seminar, every single one of those instructors, again, has to be approved. So you have to submit their letter of reference, their CV, or every single time.
I don't like that. I'll just be candid and say, I think that that creates a significant disincentive for a presentation of quality continuing education.
Like, couldn't we have a list of instructors that have already been approved? So if they're on the list for the seminar, it's just not an edit, right?
So if a provider said, okay, these are the four speakers I'm going to have. They're going to talk on the courses. They're going to present the courses that they've already had approved.
It's not, not their course. That's the problem here. If Larry Lazara submits an application for a course and doesn't include them, we don't know that they were ever associated with that course. It doesn't matter if their course is approved. It doesn't matter. We're talking about Larry Lazara's course here. So for the purposes of Larry Lazara, nobody else in here, just Larry, he's got to have those in there so the board can understand who is teaching what at each seminar.
Okay, so let's talk about the difference between a sponsor and a presenter, because my understanding is if an instructor provides their material at a course that is sponsored, like the State Chiropractic Association or whomever, does the sponsor have to credential their entire course, including recredentialing everybody that they bring in? So if the State Association has foot lovers come in, and they have to submit continuing a full syllabus for that particular provider, and as part of that. Wow, that seems
But here's where things get really tricky. If we go down the road, you kind of are leading us down. Say I get a 4-hour course put together for records keeping and documentation. I'm offered the opportunity to present at the seminar. They only give me an hour. And I knock out 3 hours of that course and only teach an hour of it. They submit to us under that AZCE approved number. We have it as a 4-hour course. They only took 1 hour. They can list it as a 4-hour course, and I can't prove any different when it comes to their renewal because it's a different course.
Sure. Right. So the problem with that situation that you've got is, what about the doctors who have courses that are approved for 24 hours? You know, you don't expect them to go in and do a 24-hour presentation, and it's all covered under one code. I think you guys need to figure out a better management system for those situations, because if Dr. Gallagher or Dr.
We're not agendized to discuss the process today. If the board wants to re-agendize it for next meeting, you know, we can look at all the rules and see if there's anything you want to get rid of or change, open rule packages. But I think right now we need to deal with the rules and statutes as they are and make a determination here.
Just a real quick comment, because this is, I think, I think what I'm seeing a little bit differently, Dr. Bennett, from yours is, you know, if you want to bring a group of people together to present CEs and they've had courses that were already approved, just bring them together. They can do them back-to-back-to-back over an event, CE extravaganza, or whatever you want to call it, because they've already been accredited, have the course outline, and they're cleared to teach that in any capacity. So if you want to bucket them, just bring them together and have them do the courses throughout the day is my thought on that. Whereas with Dr. Lazara, if you're going to have a panel of people on a consistent measure, I do think that just needs to be listed, which I don't think is a crazy requirement to say these are the other presenters that will be in the course.
Well, in order to do that, my understanding of the law is that each of those individual providers then would have to keep attendance on their individual course, provide their individual certifications, and so forth.
And this is why some states throw up their hands and say, we're going to just accept PACER-designed classes. So that said, it's 12:14. If anybody is joining remotely that is here just for the attendance purposes, if you haven't left already, you can. But let's come down from 20,000 feet to 5,000 feet. Let's deal with the issue here today. With the law being what it is, are we comfortable or not with allowing this course, or should we piece it apart a little bit, or have them resubmit it in a way that makes more sense with the doctors that are going to be on the panel?
And I think maybe I can help with this. I think for the doctors who are going to be on there, I don't think he needs to resubmit an entire new application. If he just provides the information to the doctors, then call it good.
Correct.
That would be correct.
Yeah.
I don't understand what you just said.
If he were to just send staff the documentation for the people who are going to be on the panel, there's no reason to resubmit the entire application and everything.
Oh, I thought that would be the opposite of what we just were discussing. Okay, I'm fine with that.
Yeah. That was my understanding. I feel like if we just get the CV, whatever is required for the presenters,
yeah,
we're good, and we can improve this course and move forward.
And so then they would be able to speak to the traumatic brain injuries and present on the psychological portion of this. Is that what you're looking for?
I think that addresses the panel.
Okay.
I think you all need to make the determination about the other portion, which would be the traumatic brain injury. Does that fall into record keeping, or does it fall somewhere else that's not within the scope?
And maybe he does want to send an amended application to the board. It's up to
my issue on that is, I don't see that he's identified who's on the panel. Maybe I missed it. So under subsection E of 801, if the applicant changes the initial date of the course or the course content or the instructors, right now he's the only instructor, it shall be considered a new application. Right?
I believe that his application is open, though.
Okay.
The staff is, because you guys haven't made a determination. So he could still, you can make a motion to,
I got it,
fit on receipt of those.
Okay.
That information.
So you just need CVs from a neurologist and a psychologist who would be on my panel?
I think you'd need to at least fix the question 18 on your application that discusses what each instructor is going to cover.
Right. Okay. I can do that.
And then perhaps clarification with regard to the elements of the areas in question, such as traumatic brain injury, that are being addressed from a documentation and compliance point of view, as opposed to anything relating to diagnosis or treatment.
May I have some clarification on what the, with me, the lawyer, would be permitted to present on the topic of traumatic brain injury and psychological injuries, because I'm unclear on what I can and cannot present under the umbrella of record keeping.
You'd have to hire an attorney and go over the rules and statutes to make sure you're in compliance. Not an advisory board, so we can advise your opinion.
Yeah, we got three attorneys in this dialogue, but nobody can render an opinion.
Looking like a true lawyer. All right.
Okay, so do we need a motion to deal with this today or direct staff to?
We're going to take no action today and then let him follow up with staff.
Okay.
That's fine. That works for us.
Yeah, and if you can provide everything, then it can be approved. If not, staff will bring it back in next meeting.
And we can retroactively approve the course of individuals have already taken it. We can retroactively approve it and they still get their CE credit.
Does that require a motion?
To take no action?
Yeah, no motion.
No motion. Okay, let's just move on.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. All right, we're going to move on to tab number 7 now, which is our regular board business. Andrew Beam, Executive Director.
I have the cash flow report for our financials for November and December. If anyone has any questions about that. All right. Also included in your packet, I included the Joint Legislative Budget Committee's baseline budget. You will see that we are allotted for five staff, which we currently hold five FTE positions, but as you know, there's only four of us because we don't have the funds to pay for the fifth person. And they, in terms of our appropriation, there's no change in the allotment. They're going to take away about $3,000, which was tied to the Cynthia upgrade that they were moving us to. So that one-time monies are going back to them. And also included in the baseline budget, they did say that based on their forecasting, they have funding for one-time options, but not ongoing. Additional staff would be considered ongoing. So they're not really entertaining that at the moment. I also included in your paperwork the governor's executive budget, and you will see that they did include in their request for the executive budget was to restore the funding for the position for the deputy director, which we currently don't have in that position. So they would restore about $50,000 to our appropriation and then reduce it by that 2.8 for the Cynthia. So there's that. And then also there is proposed legislation regarding our license renewals to kind of take us to that revolving, so no more year end. They currently have the language as birth month. And I, with your blessing, would like to go out and advocate for issue month. Part of my reason for that is due to how our system works and our database, in an effort to protect confidentiality, we haven't, not for all doctors, I want to be clear about that, we don't have birth dates in the system for every doctor. So we have everyone's issue date. So if it could be that it expires the month issued, I think it would be better. But then further down the road, when we issue a license, if it's by issue date, then they get a full year before they have to renew. So if we issued them a license and then the next month is their birthday, they'd only have 30 days of that license. So this way, from the time we issue the license, they would get a full year prior to the expiration of that license, which would be consistent with what we're looking for. So that would be kind of what I would like to advocate for, but also would maybe like some assistance in advocating for that additional staff person. I think based on what you've heard in this conversation, CEs just continue to rapidly increase, especially with the opportunity for online education. The majority of your colleges and universities are just inundating us with courses to be approved. We got so many that in first process license rules, we had to stop accepting CE applications because there's no way to manage both. And I think if we have a person who's renewing licenses monthly, I think that's going to take probably a full-time FTE based on our calculation because it takes about 8 minutes per application. So we figure that, and with like kind of backstopping some of the support for the licensing team, that having someone just to be able to process renewals, because that deputy director position is going to be eaten up with additional investigations, monitoring. Part of how we advocated for the funding for the deputy director position is we are assuming as you start to accept Medicaid funding that will be additional investigations that will start to come this way as those referrals from access will start to come to us.
Do you think that the issue date, do you have a sense of if most chiropractors graduate in a certain month and then decide to come to Arizona, I'm guessing it won't be spread equally throughout 12 months. You'll probably still get inundated any certain month or two, and then maybe another quarter later, or does that solve the problem or make it better?
I think it solves the problem because it's not.
Everybody has
500.
Yeah.
If you think better than 2,500.
There's also getting the additional documents that they may not have sent in, plus the background checks could take 2 months. So, I mean, they kind of get spread out, and then we have some providers from other states that decide to, they want to get licensed out here, and it's not depending on when they graduated.
This is not my wheelhouse, but is there not just like an you mentioned PACE accreditation going to the continuing ed option? Is there just not, you know, I know the short term might be throwing a body at it. Long term is probably process. Is there just not an easier route there that Arizona can take?
Well, so that would require a rule change. We already do, in terms of PACE, like the vast majority of like colleges and universities, they are PACE pre-approved, and so we have an expedited process for those, so they carry kind of the weight of those, and so those move through rather quickly. But there's a lot that don't meet that, and I think when we get down to it, it is more of the ones that are local providers that are not associated. They're not PACE, and so that's where, and they require a little bit more hand-holding.
Okay.
But I can tell you, I think, I don't know that you were at the meeting, but I think right before, back in October, I think staff, what we did, like 300 in like a month. And it took all four of us.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so. And it's, and two, again, not a great process. Like, we're managing the whole thing out of a spreadsheet. So, and we're still using paper files. Like, we're trying to transition to electronic. It's just, it's slow. It's, and then, like, two, we're cleaning up. We're still cleaning up mistakes that happened 4 years ago. So, that don't come to light till now because they're renewing the course or whatever. And, you know. So, it's just, it's going to be sticky for a little bit, but we're working through it.
Okay.
I provided you with a licensing update just to kind of see month by month. You know, the lowest month we had was 4, highest being 13. So, again, it just depends on how those applications come in. Legislative update, I provided you so far the only bill that we've seen, and maybe Dr. Bennett can speak to this better than I can, was a bill from Senator Kavanaugh regarding the practice of chiropractic bill limitations.
I spoke with Barry Aarons, the lobbyist for the Arizona Association of Chiropractic. This is a bill that is initiated by the AAC. It brings clarity to, the genesis behind it was clarification relative to diagnostic capabilities of chiropractors. Specifically, there was an initiative for being able to do COVID testing and so forth. You know, where do we draw the line in terms of scope of practice? And so this is just seeks to clarify. It does not represent any kind of new or innovative issue. It just clarifies and helps to redefine a line in a changing environment. It is sponsored, and I brought up the question of, okay, well, we are always nervous about opening the Pandora's box of scope of practice, but what are we concerned about relative to getting ambushed on that? And his comment was that Senator Kavanaugh is a longtime friend of chiropractic, and if there were, as a sponsor, and as if there were any move made to bring to bear unwarranted or unwanted changes, he would simply withdraw the bill. So I'm not concerned about it. I think that in general it's a good bill to seek clarification.
Can it turn into another bond case?
We don't.
Is that what you're saying?
um, I also provided you with our case statistics. As you can tell, the last three agendas have been lighter. Part of that is back to that staffing issue that we kind of go back to. It's really hard to investigate cases when you're processing renewals. And so Ryan has been part of the team, like stepping in, helping process renewals, reviewing these matters that were they've indicated something's changed with their license or that they're under investigation. He does the second step of kind of investigating those renewals when they come in. Or so part of that's the staff. It takes all four of us. We're processing about 65 a day, but I'll get to that. But we finished all the cases from 2018. We have one left for 2019, and that is Eager. We got notification that he's actually been incarcerated now, so we'll take that interim order, and we are working to – we sent him a voluntary surrender. I'm guessing this is going to be a little bit of a slow walk because we had to mail it to the jail and probably have to mail it back. So – but we're working through that. We have three cases left for 2020, and all of those have been for you, but some of them are just state and criminal processes. So there's that. We're working through the rest of 2021 and 2022. We've already received 19 cases for 2023, so we just kind of seem to hover around that 60 mark. So... in terms of cases over the 180 days, we have 60. We have 44 total of 60 cases, so good percentage of them. And we were on the downswing and now we're on the upswing. So hopefully. I have my after-actions follow-up report if you had any questions about any of those items that we dealt with the last meeting. Renewals. So when I pulled this report for you last week, we had processed, we've received 2,134. Since then, we've received 2,145. So some of those paper applications, like as they're trickling in, we're adding them to the spreadsheet for processing. We've processed 1,430. We have about 715. 139 are deficient, meaning either they haven't submitted their application, we've gotten their payment, but we haven't gotten their application, or they didn't provide their home address. They didn't provide something. They answered incorrectly in regards to the record protocol. So we've sent them a deficiency notice asking for clarification, and just to further clarify that, those ones that are marked as incomplete, they have 60 days to respond to the board before we can close that application, and they'll have to do the do another renewal and pay the late fee. But they kind of get held in a bucket. They're not penalized with the late fee, but they do need to clean that up. And then... just as a reminder, because I think we get asked that question a lot, I'm sure you know, that last page of your renewal in the electronic, it comes back to you, is your certificate, is your receipt. We're not mailing another certificate.
Process of rescinding that
hearing, would that then, is there any further motion necessary to also move that we address it further once further information, or can we just rescind the motion? Okay, that's the part. Chairman, I would move that we, in the matter of Dr. Schillerstrom, we rescind the hearing and direct staff to bring the case back to us with further information.
Second. Okay, first by Dr. Bennett, second by Ms. Powell. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Hearing.
Have found information by providing the document and provide all the information.
That'll be helpful.
Do you have any other questions for me?
No, does that conclude your report?
That concludes my report.
Okay. The time is 12:35. I'm going to call to the public. This is your opportunity to speak to us, say anything you like. It's not meant to be a two-way dialogue, and so we can't reply. Anybody in the public, would you like to say anything? Anybody in our virtual audience attending the meeting, would you like to say anything? This is your chance to unmute yourself. Be famous. Okay, our next meeting is going to be Wednesday, February 15th, 2023 at 9 a.m. With that, we are adjourned.
That meeting will be virtual also, just for the record.
Okay, it's virtual only. Okay.